The Rebbetzin chose that song because of the nature of God's creative activity. And of course, we are now in Revelation 21. We got that far. And it's dancing. There you go, skipping around. But, you know, God is the creator, and he's about to do a wonderful work of creation. We are in Apocalypse, Lecture 160. I've entitled it Horizons of Yesterday. Horizons of Yesterday, for a reason. But before I get into that lecture, I want to quote William Blake. Little Billy Boy. The man who never alters his opinions is like standing water and breeds reptiles of the mind. Mind-blowing concept. And very accurate, very accurate. Descartes said, "No sooner had I completed the course of study at the end of which one would normally be admitted to the degree of doctor, than I changed my views completely because I found myself beset by so many doubts and errors that I felt nothing had accrued to me from my efforts at learning but the discovery that I was more ignorant even than I had supposed." All right. Yeah. As I have said many times, when we stand before the living God and open our Bibles, we are expanding the parameters of our ignorance. All right? That's a fact. That's a fact. Revelation 21, verse 1. We might like to turn there. Revelation 21, verse 1. You will find this written here. I saw a new heaven and a new earth.
Yes.
Yippee.
For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. Now, you know what? We're not going to get past that statement today. yes, I know. Disappointment reigns. Or is it exhilaration in the anticipation of what's, of what's coming?
It takes you back to the old days, and we used to do that in the old Coffs Harbour days. We'd do maybe two verses, and do you remember that?
Hey, two verses. Well, we've completed Revelation 20, all right? And we're right on the brink, of exploring the contents of Revelation chapter 21. And in our sweep of the prophetic biblical revelation, we are still unprepared. Let me emphasize this. We are still totally unprepared to dive in to deep and troubled waters where we can only guess, shock horror, we can only guess at what it is that John had actually witnessed in his voyage of discovery through eternity. When it comes to Revelation 21 and 22, we are guessing. And I'm standing up front telling you that from Revelation chapter 1 right through to the end of chapter 20, with a few little verses of exception, we basically know it. But those two chapters at the end of Revelation are going to raise questions. And if they don't raise questions, then what we are doing in our study of the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse, is taking preconceived ideas and transporting them and transferring them directly to the pages of the Holy Word, and we are not reading what it says. We are reading what we think it says. It's like the human mind's very tricky like this. It's like when you write a lecture, you write an article, you write an exposition, or you write a letter to somebody. And then you decide 5 minutes later, oh, I better read that again. And you read, yeah, it's perfect, no problems. Why do you think it's perfect? Because we know what we wrote. Actually, I'll rephrase that. We know what we think we wrote, and we are planting that on the document we're scanning, we're looking at. Yes.
How could you not ask questions about Revelation 21 and 22?
Well,
because 21 and 22, with all that there must be that goes with that, and the knowledge that created that in the first place, that's more like an editorial that someone has done on somebody's book.
It is like that.
Rather than the book itself.
It is like that. That's exactly right. Absolutely. I agree with you. Okay,
it's like Paul had a big, John had a big sleep.
You've been on Valium or something.
And then she doesn't give us any memory of how long.
No, that's exactly right. No. Yeah, and all he says,
like
and I saw.
And then all of a sudden you woke up, and here we transported to another place.
You're absolutely correct. But as I was saying before, when we superimpose these thoughts onto what we've just done, you know, we need to stop, get someone else to look at our manuscript or whatever it is, or have a good look at it yourself in a week's time. Because then you find, oh, I wrote that instead of that. Take that out. Oh, I made a mistake here. Take that out. After you've done, you know, your rerun of the article or whatever it is, you'll find about a dozen problems, including paragraphs that run into each other and words that the spell check didn't pick up because they were correct words but not in the context of what you had said. Your readings.
And much easier to do with today's technology than when you wrote a letter and
absolutely.
Often wrote it twice to get it right.
That's exactly right. True. Look, we're presently engaged in a largely unknown and impossible dream of the divine infinite. God is the absolute, and God is, you know, I always feel like I'm a hypocrite when I even use the word God. Mm. Not just because it means, you know, bull's penis, and that aside. It's too inadequate a word to describe infinite love and infinite intelligence and infinite grace. The word just doesn't give you a real appreciation. Well, it just doesn't. It lacks so much. But we are doing something in this series. Let me tell you what we're doing. We are walking together through God's dream. That's what we're doing. We are walking hand in hand together through the dream of God. And that's exciting to me.
Nightmare.
Well, you know what? It basically is a nightmare. From my perspective, it is. From the human galactic man perspective, it's a nightmare. It sure is. And again, I've often said, and the rabbits, and, well, some of you will know, you've heard me say over and over again, it is very hard to rescue glory for God out of the tragedies of life. Very, very difficult to do it. Well, unless we're self-deceived and so delusional that, you know, oh yes, well, my son was killed in a car crash, but it's all right, I've got another one. You know, it doesn't work like that.
No.
It's very difficult.
There are some people who are like that.
They're so divorced from reality that they become dissociative in their personalities. And very, very tragic. But it is this chapter, Revelation 21, which sounds forth a clarion call for a yearning hope. A yearning hope. As you read through, that is one thing we can glean from it. There is a yearning hope in there of a lost humankind for a new promise. A new promise. Filled with expectancy. Filled with anticipation. For a new world. A new tomorrow. And new answers. All right, Revelation chapter 21. So I'm not being negative about it. I'm just saying we've got to look at this circumspectly. And in fact, while they try to remain very optimistic, honest scientists realize that we have already crossed the final boundary where all desire for a new tomorrow is futile. They know it. That's why they're talking about having a colony on Mars. You know, and using scientific understanding to reverse what is going on in Mars to create a new Earth. See? Incredible. And but that's what most human beings can't grasp, what scientists do grasp. As galactic man, we are doomed.
Yes.
We're doomed. Now, world federalists, they view the same world we do. All right? And I've known a few. And I know a few. And they understand the conditions by which we are beset on a daily basis. They understand those conditions because they're going through them themselves. And they admit that they are worsening by the hour. And they have to be changed. They have to be changed by a forceful intervention by someone, capital S, right, from somewhere, capital S, in order to bring about a global solution. Right? It's going to be extra human, that answer. And we, of course, have a book in front of us that talks about a time that's right on our doorstep, where an extra human, extra with a capital E, will have the answers, apparently, to the problems of Earth. But they do share the same goal as we believers. Whether we call ourselves Christians or messianic believers, whatever we want to use for a label, it's just a label, remember. That's all it is. It's a label. They want the same thing the Christians want about when it comes to the planet, when it comes to the future Earth. The new creation that they want and the new creation we want is a paradise that's been regained. Right? That's what we want. A paradise, Eden restored. But it is on precisely how and by whom that change comes that divides us. It's precisely that. Make no mistake. The Revitzer and I knew in our past Dr. Keith Suter, and of UN fame. And what he used to call you, Glorious Glennis, wasn't it? Yeah, something like that. And he had a vision for the future. And he shared that vision with us on more than one occasion. And you know what? It's so frighteningly biblical that you expect that that's where he got it. But we've doomed ourselves by our own hands, by our own stupid folly, by our own mistakes, by our lust and our greed. We've done it. We've done it to ourselves. Planet Earth is screwed because we've screwed it. At our own grass level, you know, at our own grassroots level, we fill the airways with songs about, is there a word, forlornity? There is now. We are so forlorn in the way we approach life.
Melancholia.
Thank you, Glennis. That's the word I want. Because it's our preoccupation with that present morbidity that creates, you know, somebody done me wrong songs, you know? And we have a continual barrage of negative news about the destruction of civilization by nature gone berserk. I was just watching that the other evening on cable about nature gone berserk. And as a consequence of an abrupt climate change, and the signs are all around us, we can't deny them. Well, some politicians do, but apart from that, you know, we are confronted by the devolution of the Earth. We really are. We're confronted by it. It's in our face. And then we look at innocent children. Now, there are some in this neighbourhood, beautiful innocent children, but they are doomed because they're on a cataclysmic course with the irretrievable, irreversible, characterless drug subculture. And I fear for those children. I tell you what, I am so glad. I thank God my kids are all grown up now. Because if I was this age now bringing children into the world, I tell you what, I'd be horrified. And I'm not saying to young people don't have children. Not by any means. It's a wonderful thing, wonderful blessing. But what they face in this world, they're going to need real loving, grace-oriented parents to let them survive, to get them... James, you know that. You know that. So, but, you know, while an elite cabal of New World Order theatrical comedians look forward to the establishment of a counterfeit satanic kingdom of God, only this book, only the Bible, actually holds the answer, in my opinion, to our planetary dilemma and salvation. We do need a strong hand from someplace, and our Lord Yeshua is on his way back to... sort out the entire mess that we as galactic man have made here below. Thank God for that. In his hands, in his alone, is the power of life and death, and he will wield it. He is not coming back a second time to be crucified afresh. He went through that once. Next time, he's coming back to bring man to his knees. And I can't wait for that. I'm reminded of a passage in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is speaking of the ongoing appearances and disappearances of entire solar systems and even galaxies. And he says, this vast company of living things again and yet again produced expires. at Brahma's nightfall and at Brahma's dawn, riseth without its will to life newborn. You see, the universe doesn't have a say. That's biblical. The universe doesn't have a say about its creation and the way it is subject to... Sorry?
The way it's been designed.
This is the way it's been designed, to atrophy, to entropy, you know. Humankind is a galactic being dwelling in a transitory way on spaceship Earth as we hurtle through and around the solar star that we call the Sun, as our solar system hurtles around the galaxy, which hurtles in itself around the enormity of the universe, in a never-ending dance in that same dream that I talked about before, God's dream. And man, from his dark unknown in his cosmic pilgrimage, hurtles on a collision course to journey's end as a return to his origin in the awesome originator of that dream. That's what it's all about. That's where we're going. There could be no greater truth than that man will soon meet his God. Well, I don't know about anybody else. I want to meet him. I want to meet the original, of whom I am simply an image, and a very distorted image at that. I'm looking forward to it. Man has always dreamt of a return to primordial Eden, always. A time before sin was birthed as a result of an erroneous decision involving a tree and a serpent race. Look, here on our floor is an example of a Persian rug. And Persian rugs, every single one of them, are built on the concept of a restored, lost Eden. You've got the garden in the middle, and you've got walls right around the garden. In fact, there's a few walls. And then you've got entrances symbolic of 125,000 different ways of bringing about a restored Garden of Eden. Now, this is a tradition that is called Sufi. I'll write this up on the board. Sufi. And as I said recently, I absolutely love Sufi literature. I love Sufi poetry, particularly that of Rumi. But understand that Sufi poetry is always designed with a second hidden level of meaning and interpretation, right? That's got to be understood. In fact, it was the Sufi that created the 17th century. Sufism invaded Germany, it's up here on the whiteboard, and then England in the 17th century, and it created an alternative Christian church. It was called the Rose Croix, or the Rose Croix, depending which place you come from in France. And the Rose Croix is nothing more than the Rosicrucian fraternity. And I've been saying for many, many decades that the Rosicrucians posed more of a danger than Freemasonry ever could. And I'll talk about a little bit of that today. Not much, just a little bit. you might say, okay, well, there's the Persian rug on the floor. That's a Sufi design. What are the 125,000 doors? What do they really represent? But let me tell you what they represent. They represent religion, philosophy, education, medicine, politics, architecture, whatever. And by the Sufi joining those structures and invading and taking over those structures, they can then, as fifth columnists, gain a control to bring about the aims and objectives toward the major intent of Sufism, or the society of the Rosicrucian fraternity, the major intent to return to that garden that this Sufi mat carpet represents. It is the tradition of, and I'll put it up here, of the golden dawn. I'll write it up here. Golden dawn. Very important expression in Sufism, because it represents a time period early in our history, in the history of humankind, when there was a golden age. And that was the age of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. And interestingly enough, tales at that time of an Atlantean empire abound in all cultures of the ancient world. And this flourished at a time when angels descended in their skyships. Now, exactly the same story as we find in the book of Genesis. Very same story. They descend in their skyships. Their skyships are shaped like shields or dinner plates. And they cohabit with men and women, not just women, men and women, in order to further spread their magic, which we today would call technological prowess, super technological prowess, along with wisdom and knowledge from the stars. And all occultists are of the opinion that it was due to humankind's inability to properly control this new knowledge that brought about the cosmic ruination of planet Earth. Again, the Bible says the same thing. God looked and saw what mankind had done at the time when the angels were coming down and mixing it up with human beings. He said, I've had enough of this. So he pulled the plug. He pulled the plug and out went planet Earth. But then, of course, after that, he said, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Okay. Then, after that, it says they come back. These things come back. But mankind basically lacked the essential character to control power. And this is what we're learning today in the Ecclesia, in the assembly, in the congregation of God. We are learning to exercise character. We're learning to exercise control. By losing control, hear me, you exercise control by surrendering it. That's the power of power, all right? God, who has all power, empties himself of power. It's called kenotic disposition, self-effacement, an abandonment of our control. Because when you've got a relationship, say in a business or whatever, where everyone's trying to control, you're not going to get anywhere except disintegration. Why? Because everybody's exercising their will to get what they want, what they think is right, instead of pooling their knowledge, surrendering their self-will, and coming to a moderate understanding of issues and clear. And this happens in families. This happens in families, and I don't care who the family rep, who it is. We have it in our own home. This can happen to us, where I suddenly realize and brought to the realization that oh, hang on, I'm trying to control this. Because what happens then is the Rebbitzin gets her nose out of joint because she also is trying to control things her way. So there has to be a meeting of minds. And then, of course, Miriam, our daughter, turns around and she's been trying to control things and she says, oh, this is not working. And then the dog's outside and it's going, yes, well, I've been trying to tell you that because I'm trying to control things. And everyone's trying to control.
You guys have lost control.
Absolutely. This is what it's all about. It's all about learning to develop character.
It just reminded me when you first started talking about the old saying, and I don't mean any offence by this, but too many chiefs and not enough Indians.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I rather laughed over in California when you said that, and a couple of people raised their eyebrows by that saying. But that was really funny when it happened. Certainly, prior to the flood of Noah, getting back to where I was heading, prior to the flood of Noah, it is known by archaists that a form of masonry did exist. A form of masonry did exist. If you go to Albert Gallatin Mackie's The History of Freemasonry, Its Legends and Traditions, and Its Chronological History, written in 1906, volume 1, page 61, he outlines the fact that masonry existed way before the flood. Way before the flood, which is a rather interesting admission. So that a knowledge of antediluvian civilization was transported over into the new world by Noah and his sons is very evident to anyone who has studied ancient documents of history.
Particularly
by Ham. Well, that's...
And through his progeny.
Through his progeny. And the deluge is a historic fact. It happened. Now, you know my opinion on the deluge. It was worldwide, it was global, but it didn't destroy all human beings, not by any means. And I can show you from the book of Genesis that not just Noah and his sons, but other people survived at that time too. And I can show you from the writings of Josephus that this was the case. And from other world histories, that others were up on the mountains and all of that and they survived. But that cataclysmic event called the deluge did occur, and by joining the dots in relation to the subsequent reordering of civilization and the role Noah's children played in the foundation of the new world, especially Ham, as you mentioned, it's all there for anyone to read. The first race on Earth was black, not white. The first civilization on Earth was black. And the first system was matriarchal, not patriarchal. Not patriarchal, not by any means. It's only been that when Noah comes along that you begin to find the change occurring and it becoming a patriarchal system in society. Very interesting. And in fact, if you'll even find through Esau and Edom, you'll find through that lineage, this whole matriarchal thing continues on. What was Esau's original name? What was it? As far as mythology is concerned, Hercules. And what is Hercules' original name? Heracles. And who was Hera? Eva. Eve. Hava. The mother goddess of the earth. And so you still have this matriarchal thing still existing right down even into the time of Jacob and Esau. It's interesting. You can find relics of all of this popping up through the Bible. Now this might be a little more, shall we say, catastrophically revelatory to some people. They might go, well this goes right against my understanding. Good! I hope it does. Start to read a book called The First Sex. That's not a manual. Okay. Yeah. It's not anything to do with the sex manual. It's a book about civilization in the ancient world. And I'm just trying to think of the lady who wrote it. Google, I think, was her name. Anyway, whatever the case, if you just type into Google The First Sex, it'll come up. And it documents the ancient world and shows how it was, in fact, a matriarchal society. But after the Noachian deluge, all right, after the Noachian deluge, two secret fraternities make their appearance. Two of them. One was involved in perpetuating the pre-flood Masonic Gnosticism of Eve's immediate descendants, and now oriented, after the flood, orienting around a missing penis of a black world emperor. That's what the secret Babylonian mystery religion was all about. Osiris. That's right. And Cush, and later Nimrod's mother wife Semiramis, now I call her that because even though Semiramis was a later, played a later part in the stage of history, she is traditionally called that. All right. So Semiramis went ahead and expanded Cush's original aims and goals of his religion, because that society that she created was preserving and protecting the ancient chronicles, the ancient annals, the ancient mysteries, the sciences, all right, of that which the gods bequeathed to the inhabitants of planet Earth. Now, another interesting fact is, when you go through the biblical revelation, historically, start with the angels and work your way back to the beginning. The angels were originally called gods. And this is rather intriguing to my mind. They became angels in terminology. But you will find many references scattered here and there in the biblical revelation where the angels are called Elohim. They're called that, which is simply gods. And they evolved into angels because after a while you couldn't have a myriad of gods. There was one god. All right?
The word angel, Malachim, is the plural of king.
Yeah.
Malach.
Yeah,
Malach. Many kings.
Many kings. So, we have to understand, you know, from a historical perspective, the reality of what underscores and underlies the biblical revelation. We've got to look at that and say, yeah, well, we can't run away from it. We've got to accept it. It's there. It's there. but, having said that, in in established forms, this Babylonian mystery religion finally permeated and concretized into Romanism, the Roman Catholic Church, as an official representative of that ancient system. And my, you've only got to look at their cathedrals, the way they're shaped. You've only got to look at the stained glass windows and the shape of penises and vaginas. You've only got to look at the mystery cult of Mary worship. You know, the mysteries of transubstantiation, the little confessionals, and all of that. Priests with their heads shaved in the typical phallic form of ancient Babylon and Chaldea. You know, all of this, sun worship, still today, Sunday worship, the whole thing, it still exists in today's religion called Roman Catholicism and the Protestant daughters of Rome. It's still very staunchly Babylonian.
Raw sexual paganism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if you go to some places in Ireland, and this is something I wanted to do when we went away, but I forgot about it. Certain churches in Ireland are so ancient that when you enter in through the vestibule of the entrance to the church, over the doors you've got women, naked women, squatting right, with the vagina open and all the rest of it. I'm just speaking plainly because that's what it's, you can do that over there even now today. Because the early Celts of Roman faith had taken over previous sex worship areas. And they just recreated, but it's already there. I mean, it's revolting, but there it is. Yeah. And it's still called a Christian church. Go figure. Well, you know, this is... I love the way Catholics... And look, I love Catholics, but I'll tell you what, I love... Well, there you go. But I love the way they soft shoe, or they do a foxtrot, you know, to get away from some of this stuff. Yes, but, you know, they were ignorant and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, of course they were ignorant. But not as ignorant as we think they were. All right? So, really, they've got a lot to answer for, but haven't we all? But ultimately, the whole aim of the paganism of Roman Catholicism was agitating always for the world to... return to the Tower of Babel. And write this up here. Tower of Babel. But not in Babylon. Not in Babylon. They wanted it to occur in Jerusalem. And they wanted the Vatican to eventually move from Rome to Jerusalem. That's always been their aim. That's always been their aim. And you can find this in documentation all the way down through Roman Catholic history. Most Catholics wouldn't have a clue it's there. But it's there. And now what do we find? We find certain Roman Catholic scholars and others agitating for a third temple in Jerusalem, but under the occupation of the Vatican, under the control of the Pope. This is not something new. This has been their aim all along. All along. And people don't realize it. In fact, Shimon Peres, who himself, I believe, is Sufi, recently attempted to get the Pope to move. He knew peace to the Middle East could come if the Roman Church moved the Vatican to Jerusalem, which was an incredible betrayal of Israeli values and all that goes along with that. But the second fraternity originated later in history. All right, got it up here. Sufism invaded Germany and then England in the 17th century. But it remains largely secret to this day. In fact, if you ask most conspiratorialists, what about the Sufi? They'll go, the what? The Sufi. Sufi. Yeah, the Sufi. Not a Chinese meal. No, it's not. It's not even an Indian meal. It's a political organization. But they won't have heard about it. But certainly the old system, the original system of Kush, with its missing phallic symbolism, found its way into the religion of Sufism. No doubt about that. No doubt about that. It's preoccupied with it to some extent today. But we do know, according to Sanger Brown, in his book Sex, Worship and Symbolism, in 1922, that the ancient mystery religion of phallicism was expressed in the Rosicrucian fraternity and the Freemasonic orders, and recognized by the initiates of both persuasions. Which is rather interesting. But again, Freemasonry, people have got their eyes locked on Freemasons and Freemasonry as the big baddie of our world today. But you know what? It's a front. It was created by the Rosicrucian Lodge as a front, so everyone could get their eyes on what was happening, or not happening, in the mystic order of the so-called Illuminati. But you know what? I showed in our previous lecture that the Illuminati were the original Rosicrucians, and they called themselves the Illuminati. 100 years later, it suddenly appears with Adam Weishaupt, but don't forget, that was a terror organization that he created out of existing Illuminism in Bavaria. People don't realize that either, because they don't do their homework. They just steal off each other on the web. Okay? It's the information highway. They just go ahead and they say, oh, I'll have that, and they cut and paste and stick it on theirs, and that's theirs. No, it's not. If you trace some of the stuff back, you'll go right back to the lunatic fringe where it came from. And you've got to wade through the motions of the whole thing. Don't you dare.
No, that's what I'm thinking, the deflections,
yes.
Basically.
Well, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. It reminds me of those things that you would go into at a circus where there are multiple mirrors all around and you don't know which is the way.
Well,
out. It's kind
that's
of like
right.
Which is the real person staring
yes,
back at you.
That's right. Where you've got 28 images.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Or in this case, 125,000 images surrounding the Garden of Eden. I have mentioned the political agenda of the Sufi Rosicrucian Lodge in the recent fundamentals lecture on the 1611 King James Bible. I mentioned Robert Flood. I'll put his name up here and you can do some research of your own. Robert Flood, he was a Rosicrucian, and he turned Oxford University, I'll just write that up here, Oxford University, into a Rosicrucian stronghold, or Rosicrucian if you wish, stronghold. Intriguingly, one of the great scholars of Sufism, Idris Shah, tells us it was the fraternity of Rose Croix, the Rosicrucians, that were responsible for orchestrating the arrival of Shabbatai Tzvi. Now, this is intriguing, because this false messiah, still has his disciples today. He still has his disciples, and they are called Sabbatians. Now you'll hear the expression Sabbatians. No, it's Sabbatians. That's how it's pronounced. Sabbatians. And his disciple was a man called, I'm running out of room, his disciple was a man called Jacob Frank. He lived in the 18th century. Jacob Frank. And these are secular Jews who desire nothing less than the extermination of religious Jews. And in fact, in their rites of circumcision, they take the foreskin of a child circumcised on the eighth day, and they burn them to destroy. That's their whole aim, to destroy religious Jews. They want the total annihilation, in fact, of their own race. They want them assimilated into Gentile society. Most people don't realize that. They pretend to be religious Jews, and they integrate themselves into the Jewish community. In fact, they cherish their goal, quote, the annihilation of every religion and positive system of belief, unquote. From Idris Shah, he tells us that. Now, they're a secret society, the Sufi. But they concentrated their membership among the intellectual, social, and financial elite of the community. Interesting stuff.
Like the politicians.
like politicians. Well, they were. They were politicians. In fact, one society they invaded was called the Thule Society in Germany. Now, the Thule Society is rather interesting because they created a man who was the prototype of the coming Antichrist. His name was Adolf Hitler. And we all know from the Occult Reich books dealing with that, that particular occult organization, Hitler and Himmler and others, were very deeply ingrained in it. They were attached to it. And, you know, on the evening of the 9th of Av, when most Jews around the world reflect on the destruction of the Solomonic Temple and later the Herodian Temple, they were both destroyed, the first one by the Babylonians, the second by the Romans, on the same date, the 9th of Av, which also happens to be Shabbatai Zevi's birth date, very interesting. What they do, they don't commemorate the destruction of the temples except through wife swapping and incest. Now, this is a mind-boggling concept, but they held that night for sexual orgies. If you have a look at Hitler's maternal ancestry, you will find that there was a conversion from Judaism to Catholicism in Vienna in the mid-19th century. His maternal grandmother was a Stronach. Now, this is rather interesting, because here in Australia, I knew a family of Stronachs. In fact, it's spelt the same way, but I'm not sure whether it's pronounced that way in Germany, but in Australia, it's Stronachs. Those who would wish to distance the truth about Hitler are under an obligation to explain why it is that Sabbatians are found in Hitler's circle of close friends and acquaintances right to the end of Nazi Germany. They didn't go to the concentration camps. They stayed in his little entourage and circle of protection. And it is rather interesting that even a Sabbatian astrologer was Hitler's close friend, and he had a personal physician, Eduard Bloch, who was also Jewish, and Hitler called him a noble Jew. Now, having said that, Hitler possessed a middle name. You wouldn't have known that. But a 1924 French police file card has Hitler referred to as Adolf Jacob Hitler. Intriguingly, if you date the birth of Hitler right back 9 months, you will come to the 9th of Av, 1888, July 20. So what was Clara Potzel doing that night? I'm just asking a question. But the link is there. The idea that he was a Rothschild descendant is absolute nonsense. This was circulated at the end of the Second World War by a Nazi lawyer who, Hitler's nephew, who lived in America, gave him some rubbish, and he ran with it to discredit Hitler and try to make him out to be an actual Jew. He didn't have to. All they had to do was go back to his maternal ancestry and have a good look at his origin. Isn't it intriguing that it is a Jew who tries to destroy the Jewish race? Precisely what the Sufi Rosicrucians have been all about all along. I rest my case. In fact, I might go one step further. A man called Baruch Levy wrote a letter to Karl Marx in 1879. I want you to listen to this because it's a suspect letter. All right, there's a lot of flack about it, but this is what the letter says. The Jewish people as a whole will be its own Messiah. Now, this was written way back in 1879. Today, the Jewish people do promulgate a view that they are the Messiah. All right, let's understand it. He says, the Jewish people as a whole will be its own Messiah. It will attain world dominion by the dissolution of other races, by the abolition of frontiers, the annihilation of monarchy, and by the establishment of a world republic in which the Jews will everywhere exercise the privilege of citizenship. This is not the Protocols of Zion. This is a letter to Karl Marx. In this new world order, 1879. In this new world order, the children of Israel will furnish all the leaders without encountering opposition. The governments of the different peoples forming the world republic will fall out, will fall without difficulty into the hands of us Jews. It will then be possible for the Jewish rulers to abolish private property and everywhere to make use of the resources of the state. Thus will the promise of the Talmud be fulfilled, in which it is said that when the messianic time has come, the Jews will have all the property of the whole world in their hands, unquote. Now, is it authentic? This is the question. This is the question. And to be entirely fair, this letter has been the object of enormous research, and so far, our Baruch Levi has failed to come to light in any form of relationship to Karl Marx, or for that matter, to Friedrich Engels. Failed to come to life. So the letter cannot be given too much weight as far as authenticity is concerned. What I do find of personal interest is that it chillingly sets out the actual biblical revelation of what is expected to occur in the next few years ahead of us as far as the world system is concerned. It seems to be right on the money. Add to that the recognition by top Marxists in Russia, who turned around and says, well, I've been researching Karl Marx for years. And he said, we've only got 16 volumes of his personal letters and all of that. He says, but we know there are 104 or more volumes of his letters that we haven't even looked at yet. So when people say, well, there's no Baruch Levi, well, we want to be very careful about this, because there's a whole lot more to have a look at in relation to Karl Marx and his personal and private life. So I'm just throwing that in for what it's worth. Certainly Hitler was a prototype of the man of sin that's coming. The Sufi Sabbatians propound a doctrine of perfection through sin. One must break the biblical laws in order to become perfect. Man is a sinner, and that alone is his salvation. He has no need of a personal God, for he is God. Now we can realize, can we not, how it is that a man in the near future will arrogate to himself the title of a god. And this is previous to possession by a fallen religious cherub in Ezekiel 28. Because Bible prophecy does tell us at the end time there will be a handful of men who will bring about a world federal state and enslave our planet. It will be extremely short-lived. The secret agenda and intention of the Sufi Rose Croix is the destruction of the Jewish religion and the assimilation of the Jewish race with the Gentile nations. That's a fact. The high-ranking members of the Rhodes Round Table group, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, are Sufi Rosicrucians. They have a map, they have a plan, they have an agenda, but the planet does not belong to galactic man. It belongs to Yeshua, the Messiah. A new world order of Mashiach will usher in a new earth, and it will be an entirely new earth. Okay, that's part one. Let's now look at part two. There's the gloom and doom. Yes?
It's interesting to see how they are bringing about God's will in effect.
Their
decision for destruction in order to bring about... A recreation,
yep,
is exactly what God is going to do.
More or less.
Yeah, and you see it in society. Everyone says, you know, what a terrible, lawless way everyone is behaving, the young, yep, the way they are, the violence in the streets and so, yep, on and so forth, until the people themselves cry out for deliverance, yep, from it, and yep, and laws are created.
Yep.
That will exact harsher punishments, and people will go, yay!
Absolutely. This is where we're heading. And you can see it all around us, even locally.
They're driven to the point of despair so that others may fix, in inverted commas, their problems, ultimately bringing about God's salvation of all through their own ultimate destruction.
Oh, they're all,
eventually,
that's right,
because they,
that's right,
they will choose the one who rises in his own name.
Yeshua said, if someone comes in his own name, you'll accept him. All right. Now, before part three, which is following very quickly, part two, I want you to think about these questions. I want everybody here to think about these questions. In Revelation chapter 20, Okay, what am I doing back there? Well, you'll remember that when I went through Revelation chapter 20, I skipped a whole section because I didn't have the answers. That was about the end of the millennium. Satan is loosed out and the whole world rises up against Yeshua. A really strange section. Question. Immediately prior to the age of the great white throne. Now, bear with me, Laurel, on this. Immediately prior to it, which follows the millennial reign of the Messiah. All right? The Dark Lord is set free from his incarceration and spontaneously seeks to deceive the whole world. That's it. He's a specialist at that. We all know that. Deception, a big thing with him. Question. What purpose does God the Father have in subjecting the earth's population at that time to deception? You've had a whole 1,000 years to build a beautiful, awesome society where everyone is happy and joyous and there's productivity and they've got a whole earth that's totally and completely orienting and constellating around Yeshua. And bingo, he lets the Dark Lord out to destroy it all. Question, why? It is true that those who have lived through the millennium only have their human nature to contend with, in contrast to the three-pronged attack that you and I have to put up with. We have to put up with the lark, with the dark lords.
The Dark Lord having a lark. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. We have to put up with his temptations. Yeah. We have to put up with the Dark Lord's world system. We have to put up with our personal inner opponent, which is worse than the Dark Lord, the Bible tells us. Human nature is the most evil, corrupt, obstinate creature on earth. Not the Dark Lord, it's us. It's human nature. It's us, human beings. We have to deal every waking hour of our lives with human nature. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. Even though we become converted believers and we love the Lord and all of that, we are still open to the negative impulses of our hearts. We are. And we can't run away from it. But having scoured Bible commentaries of every description, eschatological volumes by the ton, early church beliefs in the Ante-Nicene Fathers, without coming up with answers on this question, without coming up with any answers, and only further questions, which I'm not going to give you because you're fatally shattered. All right, listen to me. I don't want to labour you with all this. I purposely left that section right out of the Yeshiva lectures on Revelation chapter 20. Right? I left it out. So that's my first question. What was God the Father's intention?
I know.
You know. Tell me, please.
Because they've not had any temptation or whatever, and now they have to be tried and tested. And the only way to do that is to bring back the thing which has been trying and testing humanity since the beginning. The temptation from the evil one.
Because ultimately, they might have Yeshua reigning on earth, but they don't possess his Holy Spirit, nor are they elevated to the status that we have already been elevated to. These are still human beings with human nature, still subject to outbursts or, you know, whatever it might be, killing, whatever. So the Dark Lord has to be released upon them for more of a sifting process, more of a refining process to occur with them. Yeah, I see that.
Good. Second question. Now, this is why I'm opening this up. I want everyone's input, not just Laurel, I want everybody's input. All right? No, don't you dare. I'm quite happy with that response. I've got a few questions about it, but I'm quite happy about that response. All right, second question. The revolutionaries under discussion in Revelation 20, who go around and they deceive the whole world by the power of the devil, have an entire millennium of exposure to the Lord Yeshua's reign. They have dwelt in a perfect earth system of loving management under his caring shepherd rule yet they rebel, and as a consequence they are destroyed by fire out of the heavens, that's what it says, which devours them where they stand. What then? Now remember, this is just prior to the great white throne judgment. And this is something you brought up, so this has added to my misery. Because you raised a very interesting question that I hadn't considered. What then? Because it would seem purposeless for them to be brought back to life in the great white throne judgment, period. And what's the point of that? They've just had their whole existence through the millennium. Right? This is what Laurel said the other day. She said, well, why? What would be the point? Good question. Because it is a result of that period of judgment that death and the unseen realm of the dead, both expressions mean the death state, right, are annulled. They're annulled. It is the death of death. So then, what happens to them and under what conditions? Yeah, pregnant pause here.
What happens to them?
You cannot pay your own penalty and gain eternal life through your own effort. It has to be through Yeshua. Therefore,
they've got to face the white judgment.
But what is the point of facing the white judgment when they've already been under judgment during the millennium?
Well, to fulfill your theory of universal salvation.
Oh, well, yes. Totally agree with that assessment, but I still have this nagging void inside saying, why would they have to come up in the great white throne judgment when they were already being exposed to God's loving understanding, judgment, care,
still,
and all of that?
That was just humans. They did not have that connection.
They did have the connection. They were there.
But to some, can you imagine? This is a totalitarian regime. Even though it's in love, if true love does not exist within them, then they can't recognize that true love. Because that true love is going to have a lake of fire burning during that time period, which will be a great incentive not to want to do anything wrong.
Point.
Until you are deceived at a later point in time that things don't seem to be quite what they seem. Well, in actual fact, they are. But
yeah, I know. Yeah.
If they are deceived.
Well, it says Satan deceives them.
Then they have to be judged for that deceit, don't they?
And wouldn't they then say, yes, we were wrong, because they will then see that they had all that. They blew it. And that they obviously, by their own steam, cannot attain that which we have attained. Unless Christ does it for them.
What about the meaning? It talks about God and my God, which have been interpreted in many, many different ways, but there is an understanding we're talking about from the distant, I think it mentions in the Apocalypse, from the ends of the earth. So we're talking about places that are obviously, the whole earth is under Yeshua's rule, but there are stations of rulers as well in any kingdom, in any administration. The people at the ends of the earth are under certain administration. Is it angelic administration? Is it sort of humanoid or children of God, discipleship administration? Exactly. Is it spiritual? It's not. Those ones put there to rule over the people. I mean, it's never the sheep. It's always the shepherds. And since Satan comes to deceive everybody and blind them again and cause them to uprise and have a revolt against Yeshua, which is essentially what it's saying. That those ones that are dignitaries and are ruling over those people at the end of the earth, surely they have been chosen for that reason. They've always, angels can fall at any point. They can be servants of light and all of a sudden become servants of darkness. Would it make sense that they're the types of rulers that are put over these people in order for this to take place? And I'm not going to say that these sheep are
We're reading a lot into Revelation 20 verses 7 through 10, but it is interesting.
This is just a review, it's not the point.
Hey, I'm throwing the questions out there for everyone to talk about.
I'm really seeing too much into it, because he said, you sit on my throne and rule. You will rule over the 12 tribes of Israel. There are places in my... We hear that there are stations of leadership and rulership, and if people are under his rule, under in a kingdom rule at the very ends of the earth, there are people appointed over them, over those communities and so forth. If they are somehow doing the wrong thing, whether people uprising against them and uprise against Yeshua as a result of that, we don't know what really causes it, except the Satan's involved, deceiving them.
That's all we do know.
And we can only imagine from what he's done in the past that history could repeat itself, or he could use a new vice. Who knows? But
and we don't know how long it lasts.
If they're deceived by Satan himself, are they responsible? Because Yeshua said about the coming Antichrist, even the elect among you could be deceived. If that is possible, okay? So we're dealing with a huge deception.
Ultimately God's grace and mercy in the end.
And that's exactly what I'm saying. Can those people be held, will they be held ultimately accountable? Because from what I understand, it's Satan who's thrown into the lake of fire at the very end of it. It doesn't say that whole cohorts of people are thrown in there.
True.
Are all of the Gog and Magog people that came against him at the end of the age all
No, but they all died by fire, because it says fire falls out of heaven.
Okay, they all die by fire. What does that death mean? And here we go back to explaining what this death is. What does it say in Greek? Has it been reinterpreted? What do the oldest manuscripts say? Is there another way around that? To me, it's a technical thing.
Okay.
Would they be less judged than the sons of Korah?
That makes Yeshua a joke. Because he is the one who is going to give us our reward. He is the one who is going to put us, whoever, his first fruit, in charge of the cities and the town. And if that happened, he would be the one that had made the mistake by putting that person there. So that
but
could not possibly be right.
He called Judas as a disciple was no mistake. He called Judas because he was the devil. Because he was a devil. That's what he said. How about I called you 12, but it's not one of you a devil?
And if God's people are overseeing the overseers, then we are the ones that report to God on it. But it would also be a similar regime as what we have in the spirit with him, that we can run our own merry way and not consult God about our putting our plans before him as much as those people in that time period will do. And we, like God, would be in the background going, okay, enough rope, let's give him enough rope. Yeah, and they'll go hang themselves.
Well, of course, Simon Peter denied him three
God
times.
We see it in people that we've known here, that they have to be let go in order for their spiritual awakening, perhaps at a further advance down the track. So I'm sure that we will be doing that in that world system. We'll have those offices of overseeing, but we'll be overseeing the overseers.
Again, I also think that Yeshua called Judas for the purpose that he was to fulfil. And he says it way prior to the Passover, the Last Supper. So there is a reason that has to play out. There is a reason everyone has to be deceived for the last time. There's a reason fire has to fall to do that last bit of that purging. And then the new, unfortunately. I don't think everything is down to God's own hand, but I think when you're talking the question
of appointing... That's what I mean. People can run away with their own thoughts and their own ideas, no matter what God says.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the second question.
No, that's fine. Because God has a plan. And sometimes we cry over spilt milk. Some things happen in our lives, and we have terrible, terrible trouble getting over it. But that is our fault. We are the stupid ones that because that happened because it was in God's plan. We didn't want that person to die. And if we reorder that for the rest of our lives, oh, poor me, my so-and-so. We have to get rid of all that garbage out of our lives, because it's gone past, forgot. We can't do anything about it. It was in God's plan that happened. And we don't know why, but God knows why.
That's
and
right.
So we frustrate our own lives, worrying over things that we can't do a thing about.
That's very true.
And so it's all in God's plan.
Yes, it is.
And he is going to
fulfill
that plan.
That's all through God's mind that you come to accept that occurrence.
Yeah, we have to.
All right, so that was the second. Now, I'm enjoying this. and I want you to continue. I want you to keep thinking. Third question. Gog and Magog are mentioned prophetically in other places of the biblical revelation, notably Ezekiel 38 and 39. But the timing of their hostility is to be differentiated from this millennial period under discussion. Now, to my mind, this entire episode seems totally and utterly pointless, to be quite honest, and in a prophetic sense, contradictory. So how can we, or even should we, attempt to reconcile this passage with that of the prophet Ezekiel? Amos.
Unless we're dealing with another type of rule of Yeshua on earth in accordance with an age. I mean, we've had 2,000 years since he has ascended to the heavens. Okay, yeah. Is it possible that there are segments of his rule on earth? Just say, I mean, for argument's sake, times when I could say a Christian spirit, a Christian attitude would permeate the world, a time for believing growth, the body, the ecclesia of the church would be growing and ruling for a certain amount of time, that at least in essence, at least in, you could almost say, the shrines of society, you know, the moral, ethical code of believers, and just before the return of Messiah, this war takes place, and that it is a millennial war. Are we not interpreting it at the age which it's called? Because everything in Judaism in the Bible is according to an age. Are we dealing with a couple of different ages?
The flow is at the end of the thousand year reign. That's right.
This happens, but in Ezekiel it doesn't appear so. It happens at the
very return,
the demise of the Antichrist.
Yes, absolutely. And herein lies this is where the tension lies. You see. Because I find it insulting my intelligence to say there are two lots of Gog and Magog. That insults my intelligence. It just really does. So, okay. Fourth question. Interesting response. Fourth question. How long does the age dominated by the Great White Throne last? You see, something as important as a Great White Throne judgment.
No, I've got no idea if I'm asking the question.
It's a long time. You know? And yet it seems that, you know, while the millennium is a given, you know, 1,000 years, that's what the word millennium means, no indication of the time involved with the Great White Throne Judgment, and I find that rather astonishing.
Till the job's done, I guess.
All right, fifth question. When you get to Revelation 20, verse 15, the very end of Revelation 20, and you look at Revelation 21:1, there's a huge unexplained gap. There's a huge gap.
Like neglect into the future.
Like a suddenly, you know, all that's irrelevant, and now here is this. Did the gap arise as a result of an early copyist's error? All right. Because if you remember, Revelation chapter 2 and 3 is inserted in the wrong place. Remember that? Remember when I first began these lectures, I talked about the letters to the ecclesia. And it really should be put at the end of the apocalypse as an addendum, because it's inserted between Revelation 1 and Revelation 4, and it disrupted the entire flow of John being caught away into a wormhole.
Yeah.
The
warning to the churches. Yeah,
that's right. And you sort of go, what happened there? And but if this gap did occur through a copyist's error, it had to have occurred at a very early date, because we have manuscripts from a very early period of time of the apocalypse, and we've got thousands of manuscripts in existence from a very early period. So if it is a copyist's error, then what on earth did the copyist lose between Revelation 20 and Revelation 21:1? And if not, what was John's purpose in nonchalantly skipping over this important interval between the end of the world and the beginning of the new creation? Because Peter mentions it. Peter says the elements are going to melt with fervent heat, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen, and and the crust of the earth's going to explode, and you're going to have molten lava, and it's going to, you know, destroy the earth. John just goes from Revelation 20, verse, I think it's 15, straight into Revelation 21, and he says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. You sort of go, whoa, hang on a minute, what happened there? You know? And I'm one of those intellects that likes to look at that and go, I like a flow. If I'm reading Psycho, I read that years ago, I would want to know what happens in flow, and not read the first six chapters and then jump to chapter 22 and say, what happened in there? Or
this
whatever.
This is a vision, and therefore,
well, it's not necessarily
going to make sense.
Careful of the word vision. It's what he saw as he was traveling. And he was making a note of everything that he saw.
Some things are sealed, though, aren't they?
Well, he doesn't say that.
He does say that he does mention that he was told that certain things were to remain sealed. An angel tells him.
Yeah, particularly in relation to a specific incident.
Okay, could that also?
Well, we don't know because he doesn't say. It's just
exactly
a sudden gap.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, it's only an assumption or a hypothesis that could repeat itself again.
Well, it's possible. Good point.
Well, maybe not. Yeah. I might say, okay, this is going to be really bad, but don't worry. Because I just saw that everything turned out really well. I mean, we don't.
Yeah, maybe he was so horrified by what he saw on his travel that he went. All right.
That's going to take a long time, that from verse 15 through the Great White Throne Judgment, isn't it? We've got to presume for all the people that have ever lived.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time, but we're talking about the destruction of our present planet and the renewal of the next one.
Yeah, well, that's after all the judgments have been given out and all that. They've all been through the fires, and by that time everyone is perfected.
But it doesn't. Yeah, but that's because we're having to draw from every other scripture in the book of in the Bible to get that flow and insert it.
And if you read on a few verses, which we're not doing today.
No, we're not doing today.
But if you do read on a few verses, then if God's coming to dwell with humanity, then it has to be some kind of different world and humanity for God to be able to dwell with them.
Yeah.
This brings me to the sixth question. Is the first heaven of Revelation 21, verse 1, the Milky Way galaxy, in which we have been familiar, it seems, forever, okay, the Milky Way galaxy, or is it our solar system? Remember, the Bible's Jewish tradition talks about seven heavens, but the Bible only mentions three heavens. I'm going to get very pedantic on this. I believe in seven heavens. In fact, I believe in 940 heavens, but that's irrelevant. The Bible speaks of the first heaven where the birds fly, where our aircraft can be seen and all of that. Then there's a second heaven where the stars are. Then there's a third heaven where God is, the three heavens. If the first heaven is going to be the area including our solar system, I could understand that. I would grasp that. But if it's talking about the Milky Way galaxy and the entirety of the universe is going to be recreated. Mm. I find that singularly astonishing.
Where God's realm actually, that which is the Yah, becomes one with the
with
way.
The way, yeah. Not distant, not the opposite.
No, not the image anymore.
Not the image.
But
good point, thank you. I'll make a note of that image. Yep, I like that. In other words, we're looking at an alchemical change from spirit into from material into spirit. Okay, seventh question. Will the creation of the new earth really be a new creation, or will it be merely a renovation of the present earth with which we are familiar? And this leads me in. This question leads me in. I'm not letting anyone answer that.
That's right.
Look, what we think we know is different to what is real. What we think we know. We started talking about this earlier in this lecture. We can think we know that our article, our exposition, our book, whatever it is written a certain way, but when you read it later, you find it's not the way you thought it was. It says in Revelation 21:1, the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. They're gone. Therefore, how can this present earth, and this, again, I've met many believers who believe this present earth is going to be renovated by God, we're going to return to Eden on this planet. But it says here, they're gone. They were passed away.
No, son.
No, no,
different
again. Well, totally different. Thank you.
And that's the world totally of the different. Millennium, too. That's a well, different earth that's going to be.
Are we on a different planet, or is the planet
this is the question.
Off its
so what I'm going to do
cycle and looking at
that's right. What I'm going to do is stop right at this point. I'm going to stop right at this point because this is loaded and this is going to continue on for another hour and we're running out of time on this. So, but I'm glad we got to this point. Amos has brought up a great concept here which I treasure because it's my view, but I could be wrong. And again, in the next lecture on this apocalypse series, I want to open this up again. This has been really encouraging for people to actually put their piece in and to evaluate all of this. Because there are two views. Because there are two views of the whole new Earth. There's the view, as I just said, of it being a totally new planet, which Amos agrees with, in another, perhaps, parallel universe, who knows. And there is the other view that this planet is going to be renovated. It's going to be recreated, this particular one. But again, as Les pointed out, Les Moon pointed out, you know, there's no need of the moon, no need of the sun, no need of
the sea, so the moon has to control any seas.
What we have to be careful here too, because there will be in Revelation 22 a river that runs out from the throne of God, and it's described, the river. Where you have a river, you have rivers running into a sea. So are we looking at John looking in a very pericopic way at what he is seeing in the vicinity that he is seeing it, or is he seeing the great vision of the whole planet as sealess and oceanless? Mm. So here are other questions that are raised by virtue of the answer that our pastor has just given us. I know where he's coming from on that. That makes sense, but that raises another question in my head.
That doesn't mean that there is no sun and there is no moon. We don't need them because God's light is enough for this.
Well, of course. Of course it is. So you can see how it's raising.
He redid this earth in this new concept.
Mm.
We would need the sun and moon would still be out there. Otherwise, the whole galaxy would collapse if it wasn't in everything God has made.
Everything
he said was very good, right?
That's right.
Everything was
even
good.
Chaos theory,
and there would be absolute chaos if he messed up the universe.
Mm.
Whereas if he just remade,
we've got to be careful of that too, because because we know that certain collisions occur, stars collide.
Yeah.
We know that. We know that comets can destroy a solar system. You've only got to look at our moon. You've only got to look at Mars. You've only got to look at Jupiter and see craters. There was a bombardment that occurred. So chaos reigned for a time, but the universe is still running.
We've
got to be careful with that
view.
Of course he fixes
it.
He fixes it. Of course he fixes it. Of course he does. Don't you say?
I defend that the chaos theory recreates because even we are made up, our earth is, and we are made up of the dust of the previous collapsed stars.
Well, we are all cosmic stardust anyway, and we are recreated.
We are stardust.
We're all an illusion.